Welcome to the Aerospace Advantage podcast. I'm your host, John Slickbaum, and today we're going to offer thoughts and insights about the new defense budget request for fiscal year 22. As you may know, it was sent to Capitol Hill on the 28th of May, and the debates over what it means are still ongoing. Now, in the past, we called this segment The Merge, where we got our team around a table and chatted about pressing issues. And while that format will stay the same, we are changing the name. It was pointed out to us that merges may sound exciting in the dogfighting arena, but they are far from a good thing in the space domain. And we'll always admit when we've got something wrong, so to go with terminology that works in both domains, we are rebranding this segment as The Rendezvous. It still speaks to the notion of rejoining and getting together as a team, while also reflecting the operational elements of our discussions in both the air and space domain. This year's budget reflects a period of transition. We've got a new administration and a Department of Defense seeking a reset to meet a new set of challenges. Challenges that are far different than the wars of the past 20 years. The past few years have seen a lot of actions towards this latter point, but the Biden's team take on this is obviously a new dynamic in the mix. As far as the Air Force and Space Force are concerned, both are under extreme stress and more money could actually go a long way in fixing their problems. For years now, the Air Force has fielded the oldest, smallest aircraft fleet in its history, and that's occurring despite significant demand from combatant commanders around the globe. The Air Force is also responsible for recapitalizing two legs of the nuclear triad during the next several years, a significant responsibility that underpins U.S. security. When it comes to the Space Force, we need to think about a main driver for why the new service was created: money. Folks in this arena have long been juggling more mission demand than what their budget could afford. The fiscal year 22 submission will be an important indicator whether this will change. Last year, we saw the Air Force and the Space Force struggling to operate with about 23% of the defense budget. Two services operating in a budget allocation once reserved for one service is simply not viable. Hopefully, things will improve as we look to this coming fiscal year. So joining us for this first session of The Rendezvous is Mitchell Institute Space Power Advantage Research Center Director, Mr. Matt Donovan, and Senior Fellow Chris Stone. Gentlemen, great to have both of you here.
Well, thanks, Slick. It's great to be back.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
And also joining us, we have Mitchell Institute Executive Director Doug Berkey.
Hey, Slick.
And Director for Future Concepts and Capability Assessments, Mark Gunzinger.
Hi, Slick.
And Senior Fellow Heather Penny.
Hey, Slick. Great to be back.
Appreciate everybody joining here. So to kick this off, I'm going to ask you first, Mr. Donovan, what are your biggest questions as you looked at the budget release? You've been on both sides with the DOD and the congressional side of the aisle for the last several budget cycles. And how does that impact how you look at this submission?
Well, thanks, Slick. You know, I do have several big picture observations about the Department of the Air Force's FY22 budget request and the overall DOD budget. First, in theory, a defense budget should reflect your strategy and the goals you're trying to achieve. The National Defense Strategy prioritizes the Pacific Theater and names China as our pacing threat. The Pacific Theater, as we've discussed many times, is primarily an air, space, and maritime theater when looking at the potential for future conflict. So what doesn't square with me is the U.S. Air Force's FY22 request for $156 billion, as it's still over 10% lower than the Army's request. And even when you add in the Space Force's $17 billion, together it just about equals the Army's top line. Therefore, I don't see how the FY22 budget is reflecting the National Defense Strategy imperatives and the threats we're facing.
That is a great point.
Yeah, so in a similar vein, you know, when responding to a question last week about the president's budget rollout, and in response to a question about the Army being a bill payer for the FY22 budget, the Joint Chiefs Chairman, General Milley, responded, quote, "The Army is not going to get shortchanged. I've looked at this budget very closely. I think it's very balanced amongst all the services and develops future capabilities," unquote. So I don't see how the statement about balanced among the services reflects a strategy-driven budget, but rather a perceived need for proportional budgets across each service.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I just want to hop in here and, you know, for the audience listening, should they assume with the three major services that it is one-third, one-third, one-third?
You know, it changes occasionally year to year, but generally speaking, in the building, they call it the 30-30-30-10 split, which no longer applies because that only applied to the Air Force, Army, Navy, and Marines. And that didn't, you know, that was before the United States Space Force. But generally speaking, it tends to be more of an issue of fairness across the services rather than based on the threat and the mission objectives that we're trying to achieve. So another observation is secondly, when you look at the Air Force's budget request by appropriation category, several things jump out. The first to me is the operations and maintenance or O&M category, which increased by $3 billion. But this could also be a reflection of the overseas contingency operations or OCO budget, which is predominantly O&M, being reduced from $68.7 billion in fiscal year 2021 to zero in this FY22 budget request and all absorbed into the base budget. You know, I think it remains to be seen how the elimination of OCO funding will impact budget execution, as well as how it will be received in Congress. The ongoing overseas contingencies are not going to magically disappear on the first day of fiscal year 2022, about, you know, a few months from now on 1 October. And even removing 2,500 pairs of boots from Afghanistan is not going to amount to that magnitude of savings. So in another budget category, appropriation category, the research, development, test and evaluation or RDT&E category also increased by $2 billion in the Air Force's budget. But the majority of this is for programmed increases in the nuclear modernization programs. We're now entering that long anticipated bow wave of costs for upgrading the nuclear enterprise. And then perhaps the most troubling to me is the procurement category, which decreased by over $2 billion in the FY22 budget request for the Air Force. This is puzzling, as the Air Force has consistently stated how they must recapitalize their aging and legacy aircraft to meet the future anticipated threats. For example, they're going to be procuring in their proposed budget request 48 F-35s. They should be procuring far more than 48 F-35s per year to achieve the modernization that's required on a timeline to meet those threats. And I'm reminded about how adamant former Chief of Staff Dave Goldfein was at a posture hearing a couple of years ago when he said, quote, "I'm not willing to put a nickel of F-35 money into the F-15EX," unquote. Well, looking at the budget proposal, I'm not so sure that this is still holding true. And then finally, the FY22 President's Budget Request Justification Books, or J-Books, which are the detailed budget documents that Congress's the Defense Committee used to examine the budget. They don't include the numbers for the Future Years Defense Plan, or FYDP. And these numbers normally reflect the future funding for each appropriation category. Now, while this certainly preserves decision space for the administration as it looks at defense budget levels in the future, it does not portend well for future defense budget, in my opinion. And I'm afraid will signify a return to the uncertain and unstable budgets that we experienced during the Budget Control Act years and sequestration threat.
Sir, I want to ask you this. What about the pass-through? And I know we've talked about that on the podcast before. You know, the money that's bolted onto the Department of Air Force budget that's actually directed towards outside entities, mainly the intelligence community. What are the implications there?
Well, Slick, the pass-through funding in the Department of the Air Force budget, in other words, that funding that is part of their total budget of $211 billion, but where the Air Force exercises no control over how it is spent, is over $39 billion in the FY22 budget request. This is nearly 20% of their budget top line, and it clouds the actual budget numbers when comparing top lines with the other services. The other services also have pass-through funding in their budgets, but their numbers are dwarfed by the pass-through in the Department of the Air Force's budget. For example, let's take a look at the Navy's top line for FY22. It's just about the same as the Department of the Air Force's at $212 billion to cover both the Navy and the Marine Corps. But the Navy's pass-through amount is less than 1% of their budget. The Army also has a pass-through in their budget, primarily for the Afghanistan Security Forces Fund, and theirs amounts to around 2% of their total budget. So Department of the Navy, less than 1%. Army, 2%. And Department of the Air Force, 20%. What's wrong with this picture? What's wrong is it's deceiving when you look at top line budgets and try to equate the Department of the Air Force's $211 billion top line with the Department of the Navy's $212 billion when each are responsible for two military services. So in my opinion, what should happen is all of this so-called pass-through funding for all the services should be moved to the defense-wide budget lines. That's where they rightfully belong, and give both the Congress and the American people a clear-eyed view of how funding is allocated within the Department of Defense.
Yeah, sir. I mean, that makes a ton of sense to me, thinking, you know, when I just put on my average citizen hat, that I'd rather understand the budget that way instead of feel like there's hidden numbers throughout the cycle. I want to shift over to Doug Berkey. And Doug, I want to ask you if you could talk to us about the politics and perspectives behind the submission. So in your view, what's the context behind the Congress and the DOD?
No, thanks, Slick. I mean, big picture, I think we're at a strange point in time right now where national security requirements are spiking, given the number of threats around the globe, but the public by and large isn't focused on defense. I mean, just look at the last election, hardly a talking point by either side. And you know, Congress in many ways reflects this too, with a lot of members pushing back on defense spending, and they're not doing that connected to real world context. Now, you know, DOD gets it. They're aware of the challenges in play. And after 20 years of low-end warfare, they know they need to reset and focus more on the high end. But I gotta say, cash is really tight to do this. And I think they're asking the services to take a lot of risk. And if you look at the budget numbers that Mr. Donovan was talking about and the percentage and all that, and you just, you know, take 20% of the Air Force's budget, which is both Air Force and Space Force, out of the mix, that is really, really difficult. And so, you know, to get to the point, slogans like accelerate change or lose, they sound good and they have the right intent, but they depend on the Department of Defense, OMB, and Congress. You know, they got to buy enough modern equipment in the near term to meet demand, but they also have to buy space so we can have real innovation to get to where we want to go in the future. It's a stair-step approach. You know, innovation doesn't work real well at the end of a gun barrel. So what we've seen time and time again is that the services, they push for major aircraft retirements, and they hope that they'll be able to reset with new hardware sometime in the out years. But that's a really risky game, because if your future investment accounts get cut, you never get to those new airplanes. And the Air Force is a really consistent batting average with this. You know, they basically lose every time. And so you just really run equipment people into the ground because you have fewer aircraft and all that, just trying to meet the demand. And it's difficult. And so the way I look at it is, right now, the Air Force was really posturing for the last 10 years to surge with a new set of buys, whether it's B-21, KC-46, F-35, T-7, GBSD, you know, the replacement for UH-1 helicopters. Now is the time the service was aiming to get healthy. And so we've sunk billions into all this research and development and testing and early production for these types. And yet we're seeing procurement, as Mr. Donovan talked about, go down right now. So we can't get healthy. And so this is really an unsustainable approach, where we really are just leveraging these front end costs, but we're not seeing the back end benefits of it by getting to real numbers here. And so the other thing, you know, I'm seeing a lot of is focused on program next. And that's when your current programs are starting to cost you money. And they also might be having some hiccups. Everybody says, hey, let's just kill that and we'll go to whatever is the next unicorn in line. But everything has challenges and costs money at a certain point in time. And guess what? They always get fixed. You know, the first B-17s and B-51s weren't too great, but they dealt with it. And that's why we've got to stick with what we've got. We've got to get the force healthy. We've skipped modernization for 30 years. We cannot do this anymore.
Yeah, and Doug, I know you and I have talked about the right timing for divestiture as well, and that has to be, you know, baked into the whole mix. So I'm sure we'll get a chance to talk about that later on in the conversation or on another podcast. But I also want to bring in Chris Stone. And Chris, I'd like you to walk through what you saw in the space budget. What are the major changes in play that you saw?
Well, from a high-level view, the budget for the Space Force, as was mentioned earlier, about $17.4 billion, $2 billion increase from the FY21 request. However, that's mainly due to transfer of funding from the Air Force, Army, and Navy, and specifically some capabilities such as MUOS, which is a fleet SATCOM communication satellite that the Navy has. But primarily, this budget is focused on sustainment of current programs of record, geared more toward warfighting support with some focus on offensive capabilities and a transition to a more resilient architecture. On the Army and the Navy side, the programs that you're seeing transitioned over as part of this small plus up, as I mentioned, it was MUOS. Navy MUOS has a very long and troubled acquisition history, and especially with matching the satellite vehicles to ground infrastructure and ground terminals in particular. And so with the concern of Congress being a lot about acquisition for space programs, to have that kind of a program being transitioned on top of our other historical legacy programs with acquisition issues is going to probably not help the Space Force leadership with Congress coming in the near future. I'll also mention at the high level, even though the budget is an increase from FY21, which is a big help, you know, given all the budget concerns that Mr. Donovan mentioned, and the Space Force potentially, you know, having a hit, it's still only about 2% of the total Department of Defense budget. And as our own General Deptula mentioned, that is not really a good indicator of showing where the priorities of space power are within the Department of Defense. And I'm sure that we'll see Congress and senators asking similar questions about that. I believe that the budget overall is insufficient to build the Space Force up as the armed force that Congress knows the nation needs. And I'm sure that we'll see and hear that a lot forthcoming in hearings.
And Chris, I know that we talked a lot about the Space Force and the high-level view of the budget, but can you talk to us about some particular programs and any notable observations that you had on how this budget's going to affect them?
Yeah, a few examples of those that are not familiar with it. There's the Protected Tactical SATCOM program, the Next Generation Overhead Persistent Infrared, or OPIR missile warning system, and those are pretty important for supporting the terrestrial fight, if you will. So Protected Tactical SATCOM, for those that aren't familiar with it, is the Space Force's next generation anti-jam capable satellite communication system. And as the name indicates, it's intended for tactical level use by warfighters worldwide. So if you're thinking about the different levels of war, you have the strategic level, which is like the nation state level. You got operational, which is more like a regional theater, like in the Pacific. And then tactical level, just think battlefield. So with that, having strong communications is huge for command and control of forces, especially during combat operations. And knowing that our adversaries in future conflicts will do everything they can to degrade or deny that ability to communicate is very important to understand. And so this anti-jam capability is vital to ensuring that our troops in the field and our ships at sea have enduring satellite communications across the services. Protected is referring to how it will prevent communications jamming, and this is going to be done at what's called the waveform level. And so essentially, it's not protecting the software or the hardware necessarily, but it's using specific sound waves to carry the information and communications from the satellite to the user equipment in a way that's more protected and more capable of surviving a jamming environment. And another highlight of this program is its leveraging of commercial systems by a few of the payloads will be hosted on commercial or international satellites while teamed up with a few dedicated geostationary satellites that make up the system more survivable. So in for those of you that are out there that are like, what is geostationary? It's essentially a satellite that matches the rotation of the Earth. So it appears to be hovering over a specific part of the Earth that desperately needs that specific capability. And the others will be in other ranges of orbits from low to medium levels. Next up is Next Generation Overhead Persistent Infrared, and that's essentially just a missile warning satellite. It's a satellite system that we've had since the late 60s with MIDAS and then Defense Support Program, and now what's called Space-Based Infrared System, or SBIRS. This is the next version of that, and it uses infrared sensors in various orbits to detect and track ballistic missile threats. And the goal is to place 5 of those satellites in the initial constellation, 3 at GEO, which again is that matching the rotation of the Earth type satellite, and then 2 in polar orbits to watch for missiles coming over those poles. And as we see proliferation of ballistic missiles and hypersonic weapons flying different paths than what we're used to in traditional spheres, having these types of sensors will be very, very key to protecting fielded forces overseas as well as the homeland. So finally, one of the most exciting and potentially game-changing things I found in the justification book that Mr. Donovan mentioned is under research and development, and it's called Rocket Cargo. And essentially, this is a program that's funded at $36.5 million that's dedicated to take rockets similar to the Starship that SpaceX has or one of the Blue Origin rockets that are capable of landing and reusing themselves to fly cargo with ejectable pods for airdrop at austere locations. So this is something that was kind of started a couple years ago by U.S. Transportation Command, and I think it's pretty exciting to see that this is gaining some traction, and I believe it's one of the more visionary things that this budget shows, that the Space Force is not just thinking about the here and now, but are looking into the future as ways to help with other folks in other parts of the world that are probably a little harder to get to.
You can see how that fits in very well with the Air Force's plans for agile combat employment, agile basing, and those sorts of things. So I think it is an exciting development.
Yeah, and those are the things I would expect, you know, the Space Force to budget for and grow into. That's why we created a Space Force, right? So I want to shift gears to Gonzo here and talk about your analysis from the Air Force's budget. Can you walk us through the major programs like B-21, F-35, F-15EX, Next Generation Air Dominance or NGAD, KC-46, the UH-1 replacement, T-7, and the ground-based strategic deterrent or GBSD? I mean, obviously the Air Force has a lot of things on its plate.
Sure, Slick. And I'll start with the good news, which is Triad modernization. It's fully funded. B-21 stealth bomber program jumped to $3.3 billion as expected, and that includes an increase for initial production. That's great news, not just because the program is on time and within projected costs, but because fielding this aircraft will help fill one of DoD's most critical gaps, which is its lack of penetrating long-range strike capacity. The ground-based strategic deterrent program, which is going to replace Minuteman III's, funding for that nearly doubled to $2.5 billion. That was projected last year. But I'm cautiously taking that as a DoD vote of confidence in GBSDs, which have been under fire by the usual critics in the arms control crowd. Funding for the long-range standoff weapon, which will replace ALCMs carried by B-52s, also increased by $385 million. And I should mention the budget pluses up funding for new engines, radars, and data links for B-52s, which are going to be in the force until 2050. As for fighters, the F-35 buy is the same as last year's request, and funding also increases to a bit over $1 billion for its Tech Refresh 3 and Block 4 upgrades. And while that's nearly double what the Air Force projected it would spend in next year on TR-3 and Block 4, keeping those upgrades on track would be critical to enhancing the F-35's ability to win in a high-end Pacific fight. NGAD funding grew by more than 50% to $1.5 billion, at least the request did, and NGAD will eventually replace the F-22, which would be a sixth-gen capability that outpaces emerging Chinese threats. But notice my emphasis on the word eventually, because I predict the NGAD will not be operational for a decade or more. The Air Force also wants to buy 12 F-15EXs for $1.3 billion, and its unfunded priority list asks for 12 more plus spares and support equipment. And as Matt said, there's no logic from a warfighting standpoint that I can offer on this. Buying these new old jets is driven by concerns over flying hour costs and a desire to keep two fighter companies in the game, not what's needed to win in the future. Grey Wolves, the original plan was to buy 12 of these helicopters in 22 to continue replacing the Air Force's old UH-1 Hueys, which is the same number funded last year, but because of Grey Wolf design issues, which have delayed FAA certification, the next buy has been pushed into the 2023 budget. And finally, the Air Force wants to buy 14 KC-46 air refueling tankers in 22, which is two more than planned, and the T-7 trainer program is also on track.
Awesome. I appreciate that rundown. And Doug and I mentioned it earlier, but I want to ask you about the divestitures that the Air Force is proposing and how they're trying to fund this. So they're seeking to retire 201 aircraft, but only getting 91 in return. So can you walk us through this calculus? Because it sounds like a bit of a gamble since the Air Force is already at a record low level from a capacity viewpoint.
Yeah, we'll do, Slick. It pains me to say there's not a lot that I like in this budget. Starting with the cut forces today to build back tomorrow approach the Air Force continues to take. And remember that General C.Q. Brown has said there will be even bigger changes in the 23 budget. So your math is spot on. The budget will retire 42 A-10s, which would bring the total inventory to about 239, 47 F-16s and 48 F-15 CDs, many of which have structural issues because they're old. 14 KC-10s, 18 KC-135s to invest more money and their maintainers into the KC-46 force. 13 C-130Hs, 4 of the 16, 25% of E-8 J-STARS force, and 20 RQ-4 Global Hawk Block 30s. So by my count, proposed cuts and adds will leave about 2,060 total fighters in the Air Force. And of course, the bomber force will drop to a new all-time low of 140 total tails because of the 17 B-1s that are going to the boneyard this year. This math just doesn't add up. Chasing new capabilities by retiring current tails hasn't worked for the Air Force over the last 30 years, which is exactly why it is the smallest and oldest combat inventory now on the ramp. And a well-known rule of thumb when I was working budgets in OSD was never assume you will receive savings for force cuts. Look what happened last year when the Air Force tried to retire old iron to fund ABMS and NGAD just to have funding for both cut about in half by the Congress. So the Air Force loses both ways. Now, the point is, I don't oppose retiring old for new. The point is, the Air Force is assuming it will eventually get new jets to replace the old, and that's a very high-risk approach. Plus, it's doing so even though it already lacks the capacity needed for a single war with China or Russia. And what the Air Force isn't saying is even worse. It isn't telling Congress the size of the force it needs to execute the defense strategy at low to moderate risk. And it's not telling the Congress the risk of fielding a much smaller force because they simply can't afford it anything more given an inadequate budget. Now, this story is being told by the other services, but not by the Air Force.
Well, Gonzo, I think you really did tell the story well for the listeners out there to understand. And you know, Doug mentioned the P-51 and the B-17 earlier. And as cool as they are, obviously the Air Force did have to divest in those airplanes, just like we will have to divest in some of the airplanes that we know today. But your point's very well taken, and I do appreciate that. I want to shift over to Heather and talk about some other visions that are in play, because Heather's been Mitchell's leader when it comes to investigating concepts like Mosaic, ABMS, and JADC2. So Heather, how do you see this budget fitting into that vision?
You know, well, Slick, the Air Force is really depending upon the ability to share information to enable a smaller force to be more effective against a larger force. But I have to say that I share Gonzo and Mr. Donovan's concerns over how small the service is becoming. You know, last year, the Air Force requested $305 million for ABMS, the Advanced Battle Management System, which is the Air Force's vision for how they're going to share information across not only just the Air Force and all the different platforms it has, but across all the services. Now, that request in FY21 was cut nearly in half by Congress, and rightfully in my mind, and I'm a big fan of ABMS, because of poor justification. They couldn't describe what ABMS was, what the operational concept was, or how these technologies support those future operational concepts. Over the last year, we've seen the Navy and the Army diverge from ABMS, which had been designated by the joint commanders as the joint technology solution for the joint warfare concept. The Navy and the Army then pursued their own efforts with Project Overmatch and Project Convergence, respectively. So there's now indications that General Milley, the Joint Chief of Staff, prefers the Army's convergence solution, and this also then threatens ABMS. So this year in FY22, we've seen the Air Force request $204 million for ABMS. given all that context, I think this more modest request is reasonable, and hopefully the Air Force will take the opportunity to put more meat on the bone. Now, as I said, I'm rooting for ABMS to be successful because from all of my work on future warfare, the ability to rapidly and dynamically integrate heterogeneous platforms, create interoperability on the fly, and seamlessly share that information will be critical to future combat operations. That said, the RCO, their description of ABMS as a military Internet of Things still sounds really vague and like a meaningless platitude to me, because it doesn't address the really thorny problems of creating and connecting these battle networks, executing command and control, and rapidly constructing kill chains in a contested environment where we're going to see attrition. So I don't see any operational concept here, and the demonstrations thus far have been interesting, but they've also been highly scripted, not scalable, and not contested. Perhaps what's most troubling to me, and I referenced this previously, is that the Air Force isn't balancing its dire need to get healthy with this bet on the future. A military Internet of Things is only relevant if you have the things. As Gonzo mentioned, the Air Force is taking massive risk by cutting, not replacing, force structure, making big bets on a future vision and technologies that frankly just are not real, and they may not be real within this decade. So one example is the Air Force will begin retiring JSTARS this year with no immediate replacement capability. ABMS is designated as JSTARS replacement. But if you look into the budget documents, ABMS is still all RDT&E, and none of the stated activities provides the sensing and C2 capabilities of JSTARS. So that crucial C2 capability that JSTARS has provided, it's just gonna be gone.
Yeah, and I think you've just really described the pothole that Gonzo described that we need to avoid, right? We know that we do need to divest, but we can't hope and have hope as our game plan that there is a replacement on the backside. So I really appreciate that explanation. And I also want to ask you, because I know that you just released a study on the industrial base talking through all this. So what are your thoughts through that lens? Does this budget incentivize industry to invest where you think the future demands require?
Yeah, so as you said, Slick, hope is not a strategy, right? This budget will continue to hollow out the aerospace defense base and further entrench industry in the sustainment business. DoD is touting a big boost in research and development. And this is good, this is important because we have to invest in the future and catch up to China as a pacing threat. But the diminished Air Force procurement is deeply troubling, especially when the Air Force is smaller and older than it ever has been. For one, and as Doug had mentioned, we have to expect that R&D programs are going to experience problems and failures and schedule slips. That's just the nature of R&D. So gapping the force now on that hope that R&D will mature on time seems foolish. And oh, by the way, you're betting that nothing's going to happen while you're gapping your force. More critically, R&D doesn't matter if you don't harvest your investment through production. So take the B-2 and the 22, for example. Despite deep investments in developing these aircraft throughout the 90s, the B-2 was capped at 20 airplanes and for a planned 132, and the F-22 was prematurely terminated 187 aircraft from an original requirement of 750 and a final de-scoped requirement of 381. So the service basically threw all that R&D money away. So without production, R&D is nothing but an empty promise. Cutting procurement not only has had seriously negative consequences for the entire Air Force enterprise, and we've heard folks talk before about small fleet dynamics that spike sustainment costs and ops tempos, but it breaks serious trust with industry. Air Force softening on F-35, for example, is only continuing to prove to industry that they cannot trust the service on production. Over the last three decades, companies have shifted their primary business models away from production and into sustainment. That's why they are so focused on data rights and preserving vendor lock. Frankly, it's more lucrative, stable, and long-term profit to perpetuate the past than invent and produce the future. Sustainment is a sure thing, especially, as I said, if you've got the data rights and the vendor lock, while production has proven a very risky gamble. So bottom line, if you don't follow through with production, R&D doesn't mean anything.
Yeah, well, I'll beat a dead horse here and say, and if you're never allowed to divest anything, if Congress won't let you at the right time, then you're stuck maintaining airplanes and then you can't procure what you really want and need for the future. So this is-
Yeah, and that's, you know, slick that I'll mention, as Gonzo said, as Doug said, if you're gonna divest, make sure that you have airplanes in that year that you can replace them with.
Yeah, and that's such a great point. And that's really hopefully what our audience walks away from this first rendezvous with. Obviously, this is a huge topic, and we're going to revisit these budget discussions, I'm sure, over time, especially in the coming months. So I want to open it up to parting shots, and we'll go around the room here on how this will play out over the coming months. So I'd like to start with you, Mr. Donovan.
Well, I think the Air Force has their work cut out for them in justifying this budget up on the Hill. But just to pile on a little bit to what Heather was talking about. So F-35s, the total buy is 1,763 A models for the Air Force. We've got about 300 that are on the ramp now, last I heard, and there's probably another 100 or so in the pipeline. So that's 400 total. Subtract that from 1763 and you end up a little over 1300. You know, at 60 a year, it's going to take 25 years to buy the total number of F-35. So that just leads right into what Heather was talking about vendor lock and putting industry putting their focus on sustainment. That and then what Gonzo was talking about with the F-15EX being their number one unfunded priority list item is a head scratcher for me as well. So we'll see how it plays out, but I think we'll have a lot more discussions in the future.
Yeah, Gonzo here. I'd like to throw one other thought. You know, I think the Air Force is in a hole when it comes to its lack of force capacity. And this budget digs that hole even deeper in the hopes that technology to come will eventually lift it out. And I think the message it's sending to the Hill is very confusing. We've heard Air Force leaders talk about how the F-35 is the cornerstone of our future force, but we want more and more F-15EXs, which doesn't make sense when that money could be used to buy more F-35s or to upgrade older model F-22s to make them fully combat capable, which is would be a near-term plus-up in capabilities needed for a fight with China.
Yeah, I just want to add one thing that really gets lost in this 1763 number, having worked F-35 in the requirements division in the Pentagon, is there was never a plan to have 1763 F-35s all flying at the same time because, as Mr. Donovan described, you know, the production line takes so long that the airplanes that we have now will be, you know, used up or retired by the time the last F-35 rolls off the production line. And I just think from a discussion point, we're really not flowing out the entire programmatics of just this one example using F-35. So with that, I'd like to open it up to Chris.
Yeah, just one more observation. If you look at these budgets, and obviously they're meant to be five-year defense programs, but even from the establishment of Space Force, one of the things that a lot of folks, even in industry, were making comments on was the long lead times into filling the gaps of vulnerabilities that we have with threats against our critical space infrastructure from stuff that the Chinese are already deploying, such as kinetic interceptor ASATs, lasers, and other things in orbit. And so it takes forever, next 5 to 10 years, before they get to the point where they say that they will be ready to face the threat. And that, so we have this big window of vulnerability that we have to mitigate, and we need to figure out a way to plug that gap a lot faster. And I don't think we're going to be able to do that with 2% of the budget.
Yeah, it makes sense. How about you, Deb?
Well, first off, I think Air Force leadership, if I was going to advise them when they testify, they got to have a problem statement. And they've been running away from that for too long. I mean, you actually have to say, we are too small. And these are the risks. And there's a very important thing here. And Heather came up with this phrase a couple of years ago. You don't have a joint force without the Air Force or the Space Force. You know, ships at sea, forces on the ground, et cetera, they don't make it without these other systems. So we're talking about a pretty small part of the DoD budget for these elements. And yet, unless you take care of that, none of the rest of it works. And so the other thing here, and Gonzo hit upon it, and you hit upon it a little bit too, was that look at how all these pace out. I'm seeing budget folks plan year by year. So it's never going to be able to catch up. So just look at the fact that right now, the hotlines that you have are KC-46 and F-35. We don't have a hotline yet for B-21, GBSD, T-7, the helicopter got pushed off here. So if you're not surging F-35 or KC-46 now, when are you going to do it? Because it's not going to get any easier when all these other lines come on board. And kind of back to what you're saying about the F-35 numbers procured, that's actually a good thing. There was a day when we had the F-16A and the F-15A, and we divested those after a while. You brought on new technology. That's normal. We've actually been living in kind of an ahistoric period since the end of the Cold War. And we need to get back to kind of standard ways of thinking, and that's okay. It's a good thing. It's how you modernize smartly.
Yeah, I appreciate that, Doug. How about you, Heather?
I'll just say that the only way that the Air Force can dig itself out of this hole is through procurement. It has to buy its way out in order to retire legacy platforms and get the sustainment savings that it's looking for. So really, as Doug said, right now, the Air Force got to love the ones that it's with and surge production for KC-46 and for F-35.
Absolutely. Well, again, I'd like to thank you all for your time today. It's going to be a very interesting year here in Washington, D.C.
Well, thanks, Slick. It was a great discussion. I look forward to having more.
Thanks, Slick.
Thanks very much.
Thanks, Slick.
Hey, appreciate it, Slick.
With that, I'd like to extend a big thank you to you, our listeners, for your continued support and for tuning into today's show. If you like what you've heard today, don't forget to hammer down on that like button and follow or subscribe to the Aerospace Advantage. You can also leave a comment for us to let us know what you think about our show or areas you would like to hear more about. As always, you can join in on the conversation by following the Mitchell Institute on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, or LinkedIn. And you can always find us at mitchellaerospacepower.org. Until next time, this is John Slickbaum. Stay safe and check six.